You're listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. And well, I don't mean to stress you out, but if you don't listen to this episode about minimizing stress, or you do listen, but then you don't apply the groundbreaking tactics in this episode about minimizing stress, then yeah, that's worth stressing over. Welcome to the Party in My Plants podcast, where I make healthy living as fun as a party so you'll, you know, actually want to do it and then actually feel, look, and live your best. I'm your host, Talia Pollock. Now let's get this party started. This episode is enthusiastically sponsored by a product that couldn't possibly float my boat more, Four Sigmatic. My boat is so floated by Four Sigmatic's mushroom drinks that any more floating would turn my boat into an airplane because it's flying. Okay, so the first time I tried a packet of Four Sigmatic mushroom tea and a glass of hot water, I was more skeptical because of this whole mushroom thing being really trendy right now, and I'm always reluctant to hop on trend trains. Wow, we're really covering all the modes of transportation here. But I drank those shrooms and I felt truly awesome. It's hard to explain. I just felt way more awesome than I felt before I drank it. Since then, I consistently consume at least one type of shrooms a day, and it helps me know it's going to be bright, 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 sunshiny day, even when it's rainy and gray. Because I am telling you, these mushrooms are magic. Although they don't make me hallucinate in a bathtub like my ex-boyfriend's famous magic mushroom experience, which in hindsight, he seemed way too proud of. But nobody's hallucinating the magical effects of these shrooms, okay? They are ultra scientifically proven to boost immunity and gut health. Yes, please, and thank you. And the four different shrooms that Four Sigmatic uses most, hence the four in Four Sigmatic, wink, wink, they all do different epic things for your bod. Reishi helps you relax. Cordyceps give you a non-caffeinated energy for sports and stuff. Lion's mane, which does not come from a lion's mane, boosts your brain. And chaga is a mega charge for your immune system. I weave all four of those separate mushrooms into my life by way of the teas. That's what I'm talking about here, people, are mushroom teas that you dissolve in a packet of hot water and haya. But I also fancy myself some of their fancier shroom concoctions. They have this relaxing, thanks to the Reishi hot cocoa that I pretty much make every night with almond milk. They have matcha powder, which is the only matcha I now use. They have these magic mushroom chai latte packets that you can add to water or almond milk for a hot or iced, sweetest sippable treat. And I have to say, even though I don't drink coffee, Four Sigmatic is kind of famous for their multiple kinds of organic, much better for you coffee, even mocha mixes. So you can mocha chocolate. Okay, enough from me. I'm sorry. I just finished a mushroom matcha latte and I'm flying high. But because you listen to this podcast, thanks so much for doing that, by the way. You can save 15% off any and all Four Sigmatic shroomy stuff you'll want to buy off of their site, foursigmatic.com, using code PARTYINMYPLANTS. Or you can just go to foursigmatic, foursigmatic.com/PARTYINMYPLANTS to automatically save that 15%, baby. Oh, by the way, did I mention that I don't even really like eating mushrooms? Yeah, but now, thanks to Four Sigmatic, my body doesn't need to have shroom FOMO. Okay, again, hit up foursigmatic.com/partyinmyplants to save 15% on this mega boat floating stuff that I always find stuffed into my pockets, purses, luggage, or my bra because I just can't get enough. My guest today is like that lovably fiery, charmingly nerdy, and way smarter than you best friend we all wish we had. With her first best-selling book, Come As You Are, Emily Nagoski, a health educator with a PhD, changed the conversation around sexuality for women of all orientations. And now Emily has a bone to pick, a big-ass bone to pick, with another hot-button topic. Burnout. Leave it to Emily to get to the science behind the biggest health issue affecting women today and articulate the cause and solution way better than anyone ever has before. What's especially notable about this new book is that she has a personal connection. After ignoring symptoms of burnout and stress, her twin sis, Amelia, got worn so down that her appendix actually burst. This not only stressed to Emily how mega serious stress can be, but it also led Emily to bring her expert from personal experience sister in to co-write this book with her. In this episode, we got oh so real about oh so many things that'll impact how you live your day-to-day life henceforth. Man, I would not ever want to get into an argument with this woman because she has the facts to back up literally everything she says. I hope you love this chat as much as I did. Emily, thank you so much for coming on the Party in My Plans podcast.
It is my pleasure.
No pressure, but Sarah Knight said when she was on the show recently that your book would be the book of the year.
First of all, I can't tell you how much I love Sarah Knight.
Ditto.
She was the editor for Come As You Are. It was my first book ever. I could not have written this book without her. And I think I maybe would never have been able to write a book at all without her. When I heard she was leaving her job, I was already planning to write a second book. And my first selfish thought was, how am I ever going to write a book without her? She is so amazing and brilliant and spectacular. And I really envy her ability to be funny and insightful and lyrical all at the same time. I just like adore her.
Mega gifted. The goals for every aspiring writer, I think.
Yeah.
Amazingness. And as are you. And we share the same literary agent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know if you saw that in my email, but yes, Lindsay is my lit agent as well.
I'm sure that was in my brain, but I've been traveling a lot lately and I'm a bit really
no
slipped out. But
problem.
She is another person. Like, I don't know how I would ever get any books written without her. I adore her.
Dream
to
team.
Pieces. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So you don't seem to feel the pressure of the best book of the year title, but you did just write a brand new book. Well, you didn't just write it. You wrote a book. It's now out in the world called Burnout. And it is about burnout. I started reading your book and I read a little story about why you and your twin sister decided to team up to write this jam song of a burnout book. So I don't know why I just said that, but why did you guys decide to write this book?
Actually, the reason we wrote it and what it's about also answers the question of why I don't feel pressure about it being like a book of the year.
Perfect.
So I wrote this book, Come As You Are. This is the sexuality book that Sarah Knight edited. And then I started traveling all over talking about the science of women's sexual well-being to every audience I could get in contact with, anyone who would listen. And the weirdest thing started happening. After my talks, women would come up to me and be like, yeah, yeah, all that science of sex, that's great, Emily, thank you very much. But you know what really changed my life was that chapter on stress and emotion processing. That was unbelievable. Thank you so much for writing that. Culminating in Erica Mullen, who's the cartoonist who illustrated Come As You Are. She draws a webcomic called Oh Joy Sex Toy. Huh. She and I are sex educator married. I adore her so much. But she told me that she had a really difficult night when her husband had a seizure for the first time ever in his life. And it was terrifying for her, so much so that as she was dialing 911, she was like passing out. She was struggling to stay conscious. She was so stressed out. And everything turned out to be fine. They went to the emergency room. Everything was all right. They get home. She knows intellectually everything's all right, but her body is in this state of high vigilance, alert. She cannot get her body to like move out of a state of petrified anxiety.
You mean like ever since that moment?
She had been in that state for hours. This like high adrenaline, high cortisol, all the glucocorticoids in her body, just like keeping her in this state of panic. And she couldn't, like, she was lying in bed, needing to go to sleep. Everything was fine. How come I can't stop feeling so terrible? And she remembered what was in my sex book. So she wrote me an email about this and I was like, this is a... So I talked to my sister about it. My sister is a choral conductor. And her response was, no shit, Emily. As a choral conductor, her job is to embody the emotional and musical intention of the composer so that she can communicate it to her choir, so her choir can communicate it to the audience, which means she needs to teach people how to feel their feelings.
Wow.
So she knows how difficult it is to teach people how to do that. And she was trained how to do it in her master's degree. She was trained at Westminster Choir College, a conservatory training that's very like feelsy artist, getting in touch with their like all their stuff. She learned how to do it on stage and on the podium. But she said, that doesn't mean that I learned how to do it in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And she was thinking about it, she's like, and when I finally did learn how to do it in real life, it probably saved my life, she said, twice. And I remembered that when she was in her doctoral degree, she has a doctorate of musical arts in choral conducting.
Wow. That's very specific.
She is the only woman ever to graduate from any graduate program in that school in music. She's the only woman ever to finish a graduate degree there.
Bravo.
Because it's that toxic and patriarchal, and it put her in the hospital twice.
Oh my God.
Because she was so stressed out. She's saying, so the stuff you taught me about how to deal with my feelings in real life, not just on stage, saved my life. And I'm thinking of, imagine seeing your identical twin sister crying in a hospital gown, like not knowing what's wrong with her body, but feeling like her body wants her dead. I was like, okay, so we need to write a book about that.
Wow. So she was hospitalized for burnout or for something else specific?
Yeah. Burnout's not a medical diagnosis. Yeah. The way we define burnout is that it is feeling overwhelmed and exhausted by everything you have to do while still worrying that you're not doing enough. And she was definitely in that state, but she had been in such a state of chronic high-level stress for so long that ultimately an organ failed. The inflammation swole up her appendix so that they had to remove it.
Wow. And did the doctors even say to her, hey, I think this stems from stress, or is that?
Sure. What they said was, oh, it's just stress. You just need to relax.
Sure thing.
Thanks a lot, buds. That's very helpful. If I knew how to do that, I'd be doing it. And this is the thing, is that women's stress in particular gets dismissed and minimized as just stress. And my sister is, I mean, as you can tell from the fact that she finished a degree in a program no other woman had managed to finish, she is a high intensity, highly persistent, very determined, strong, powerful woman. But one of the ways she's made that happen is by ignoring the amount of distress she's in and just like powering through, just making it happen no matter what. And she found herself finally in a place where her body couldn't power through. It couldn't keep going. It crumbled. Under her.
Wow. I think a lot of people, we're all powering through.
Yes.
Like through your studies for writing the book, did you find anyone who's like not powering through living in modern times right now? I mean, that's the name of the game.
In fact, when we started writing the book, I thought Amelia's story was really extreme and rare.
I would think that too, that it was definitely wrong. Extreme. It's not extreme.
No. We have met uncountable women who said they too were literally hospitalized from undiagnosable pain, from chronic inflammation, chronic illness, chronic injury. Because stress is a physiological event that happens in your body, it has real physiological consequences in your body. Stress is not like just in your mind. It's not just stress. It is a physical event. And if we don't give our body what it needs to return to a state of peace and balance, the stress in our lives can kill us much faster than any of the events in our lives that are triggering all that stress.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, as you said, return to a state of peace. I think many people aren't even ever in a state of peace to return
to. Yeah, we've
entirely
forgotten how to get there. Maybe sometime in our infancy, our body knew how to get to a place of calm and peace. But for people who've been gender socialized feminine in particular, in the book, we call this dynamic a thing called human giver syndrome. We take this language from a very dark but very short book called Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny by a moral philosopher named Kate Mann. In it, she posits a world, and this is just the cartoon version, but just sort of superficially, there are two types of humans in the world. There's the human beings, and implicit in that title is they have a moral obligation to be their full humanity. They're human beings, and so they have to be competitive, acquisitive, entitled, pursue, and take anything they need in order to really be their full humanity. And then there's the second type of humans, the human givers, who have a moral obligation to give their full humanity to the human beings. This is their attention, their time, their love and affection. their sweetness and charm, their bodies, their hopes and dreams, their very lives sacrificed on the altar of other people's comfort, happiness, and convenience. So even as little girls, we get taught, oh, honey, don't frown, put a smile on your face. Everything's going to be okay. What we're really learning when people tell us to put a smile on our faces and be charming and nice and don't frown like that, a frown is so ugly. We're learning that other people's emotional comfort matters more than ours does. And if we express uncomfortable feelings, we're making other people uncomfortable and their comfort matters more than ours does. So we take our uncomfortable feelings and we stuff them down somewhere inside our bodies. We put a smile on our faces, pretend everything is okay to make sure everybody else around us feels okay. So they won't leave. So we'll still be loved. So we'll be connected and safe, even if we are sacrificing, you know, at 6, even 4 years old. Like beginning to break down our body's defenses because we're not allowing our bodies to express and release all these uncomfortable emotions.
So you're saying at age 6 or 8, when we're frowning because we don't feel we did well in our dance recital, or a friend didn't invite us to our birthday party, if our mom's like, don't frown, what we really should be doing at that time is crying or saying, but I feel sad, like processing our feelings. And it's the non-processing, it's the shoving that actually leads to chronic stress.
Yeah. In John Gottman's research on parenting, he uses these terms, emotion dismissing parents versus emotion coaching parents. And like you can tell by the name which one's better, right? Like It's emotion dismissing parents are the ones who say that negative emotions are a choice that you are making. And you could choose to be happy. Like it's like the clothes you decided to put on today. If you had just chosen your happy coat, everything would be okay. But no, you put on your sad coat or your angry coat. So it's your fault if you feel not okay, or that you can choose to put on a different coat, or you get punished for feeling an uncomfortable emotion, or told to like just ignore it, or to go to your room until you can put a smile on your face. Emotion coaching parents, by contrast, let you know that uncomfortable emotions are a normal part of life. When sad things happen, it's normal to feel sad. When frustrating things happen, it's normal to feel frustrating. When unfair things happen, it's normal to feel angry. And they help to coach you through the process. Emotions, as we say in the book over and over, are tunnels. You have to go all the way through the darkness to get to the light at the end. But there is a light at the end of every uncomfortable feeling when we allow our bodies to go all the way through it. It's really gendered. Boys are taught how to get through the end of some emotions, and girls are taught how to get through the end of other emotions. And none of us is taught that we're allowed just like a full access to all the full range of human emotion.
It is so fascinating that we're talking about emotion and feelings as the cause of burnout, when I think most people would think, oh, it's just too much on my to-do list, or it's social media, or, you know, all this other stuff. But we're talking about something as, I don't want to say basic, but like humanistic and universal as feelings.
Fundamental. That's the word. Because what's at the root of the impact of social media on us? Or what is at the root of our to-do list? Chapter one, like maybe the most important idea in the book, is the ability to separate the things that are causing your stress. So these are your stressors. So like family and money and traffic and cultural stuff and relationships and money and social status. Those are your stressors. And then there's the stress, which is the physical event that happens in your body, the chemical cascade activated by these things that your body interprets as a stress. And the process of dealing with our stress is almost always separate from the process of dealing with whatever problem caused our stress. The classic example of this is like traffic. So if you're, you know, if you've got a train commute, you get on the train and like the train breaks down, or you're stuck on the tracks for 20 minutes and there's nothing you can do, and you're running late and you're just sitting there getting more and more stressed out. Your chemistry is changing, all this adrenaline and cortisol in your body. And when you get out of that traffic and you finally arrive at your destination, Are you suddenly flooded with like happy chemicals and you feel glad to be alive and you love your friends and family and it seems like the sun is shining brighter?
No. No. You're like, crap, I have to, you know, get back on track. I'm so behind. It gets even worse.
You stay in a state of feeling not good. So just because you dealt with the stressor doesn't mean you dealt with the stress. Oh. You can tell you dealt with the stress if you have begun to feel better, as wacky as that sounds. So the single most efficient strategy for dealing with stress is the thing that you would do in like the environment where we evolved, the savanna of Africa. If you're being chased by a lion, the quintessential stressor, what do? When you're being chased by a lion?
Run.
You run. Yeah. So when you're carrying all the stress of having a terrible commute, what do? What does your body want you to do?
Run.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be running. It can be any 21st century version of that. It can be running. It can be going for a power walk around the block. It can be literally just like jumping up and down at your desk, shaking your hands and making grunting noises, like whatever your body interprets as like physical movement to purge your body of these stress chemicals, because it's the physical activity that communicates to your body that you have escaped the stressor, and your body is now a safe place for you to be.
No way. I've never heard anything like this before.
So this is, I mean, it's so simple and obvious once you think about it, that like, of course, your body doesn't know what getting off a train means. Your body doesn't know what parking in the parking lot means. Your body knows what running and survival means. Your body knows, in fact, what a hug means. It's another evidence-based strategy for completing this stress response cycle, and it might be my favorite, is the 20-second hug, right? So you like, you're in this stressed-out state. You get home to your certain special someone you love and trust enough that you can stand there and put your arms around them, and they put their arms around you, and you just hold each other for 20 seconds in a row. 20 seconds is a potentially awkwardly long hug, right? Like you got to really care about someone and really trust them. And that's the point. A hug that long tells your body that you have arrived home in a place that feels safe enough that you can stand this close for this long with someone. John Gottman, and I quote John Gottman a lot. He's one of my favorites. He also recommends the 6-second kiss. Again, six seconds. That's a potentially awkwardly long time to kiss somebody. Like, you got to really like somebody.
I'm going to try that. Kiss them.
And people, my husband loves this one.
Shocker.
Like every day, spend 6 seconds. That is 6 seconds in a row on one kiss, not 6 1-second kisses. Because it teaches your body there's someone that you love and trust enough to put your mouth on theirs for this much time. That physical affection changes your body chemistry. It increases your oxytocin levels and opioid levels. It's really like it completes the stress response cycle. There's like 9 of these in chapter 1. So we're just like dealing with how to cope with the physiological response of stress, fear, anger, rage, frustration, and freeze.
So you're telling me that I have so much to say. So first of all, I was in Africa in October. I did not see animals hugging and kissing. So maybe the animal-related one is the running.
Well, you didn't see the
I did see the mommies licking
the bonobos.
No, I saw mommy lions licking baby lions a lot.
Yeah, I guess humans are a massively social species, even more social than even the other great apes. And great apes are intensely social. Jonathan Haidt, the social psychologist, calls us 90% chimp, 10% bee. We're basically a hive species. We need each other so much. And we have all these different ways of expressing affection with each other. You also didn't see the lions and tigers and bears, oh my. I know that's 3 different continents, but just, you know, you didn't see them like gathered around the fire, chanting and singing and telling stories. But that's also a really powerful way that our bodies come to recognize that we are safe, that we have arrived home, that the stress response cycle can end. We can release all of these chemicals of stress activation and vigilance and just feel safe and at peace.
So it's all about completing the stress response cycle. And when we do that, Is there a shift that will just feel? Do you have to train yourself to feel it? Do you have to look for it? Is it obvious? Like, how do you know when you've completed it?
So it's obvious for me. I have known intuitively about this since I was like 14 years old is my earliest memory of being like, oh, my body's in this place. And another one of my favorite ways to complete the cycle is a big old cry.
Uh-huh.
And so I did what my body was telling me to do, which is just like lie in bed and sob for 10 minutes. And I sort of watched my body go through this process of purging this emotion in this way. It was, I apologize for this analogy, but it was sort of like emotional diarrhea.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like your body like had all this toxin in it and just needed to like let it go. Mm-hmm. And when my body got to the end of it, it just stopped. And I felt so much calmer and more relaxed. And the amazing part for me at that moment was, however stressed I was, it was interfering with my ability to think creatively and solve the problem that was stressing me out.
Mm-hmm.
And once I was in a calmer state, my brain, my cognition came back online, and I could start actually dealing with the stressor itself now that the stress was out of my body. So I've sort of always intuitively known, but my sister, my identical twin sister.
You're like your own perfect case study.
We're opposite on this. She had no idea until she was literally sitting in her therapist's office having a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
And the therapist was sitting calmly with her and asked her to describe what was happening in her body. So for minutes, my sister's like waxing poetic about like the hair standing up on the back of her neck and the flush in her face and the like speed of her breath and blah, blah, blah. And she stops talking long enough to inhale. And the therapist says, "And how do you feel now?" And Amelia stops and goes, I don't know. It's just, it's gone. And the therapist says, yeah, that's what happens. When emotions begin, they end.
Wow.
They just end? Yeah. Yeah, they end. That is the nature of emotions, is that they come and they go. They move through you when you let them.
I was just going to say, you have to let them though, because I think so many people are just running around never letting it end.
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah, and I guess that's what leads to burnout.
Yep, that's the human giver syndrome. We're not allowed. We don't give ourselves time. We're too busy meeting other people's expectations, meeting all the demands that were put on us, not realizing that our bodies need our help.
This is beyond fascinating. That used to happen to me when I would have anxiety attacks, panic attacks, where I would, you know, get all stressed out or whatever and have a buildup of emotions and then just get in the fetal position on the floor, sobbing and hyperventilating. And then after, I would feel like I'm like ready to take a nap now. Like everything was gone. I felt like born again. And it was awesome at the end. But obviously, I did not want to keep having anxiety attacks. So I worked on that. And so I guess my question to you is, it seems like the way to complete stress responses really involves in like an action, like a cry or a hug or a jump or a run or a kiss or a shake or something. What's something you can do like in public? Like if in that actual like train example, if you then get off the train and now you're late for work and you're frantic to work, how do you get this out of you, complete the stress response cycle, and then be like in your workplace?
Yeah. So three things. One, you don't have to worry about the stress not being there ready to be let go of and gone through if you pause. Like if you can't, like if you're in a work meeting and something terrible happens, somebody says something atrocious and hurtful, but you need to stay professional. So you put a smile on your face and go, I can see where you're coming from there, and do that thing we all do of placating and being nice and like stuffing your stress down. Like, don't worry that like you're going to miss your chance.
Okay.
It will sit there and wait for you. Most of us are walking around with multiple decades of incomplete stress response cycles in our bodies. It will stay there and wait for you whenever you have the opportunity. So don't worry that you're going to be too late. Second, there are things. So like if you're on the train and you can't like, you know, jog, you can do something simple like a progressive muscle tension and then relaxation, where you like you're sitting on the train and you're feeling all the stress. And so you like tighten your feet, you bunch up your toes in your shoes, and you notice that stress and you stay with your feet bunched up so long that it feels really uncomfortable. And you notice yourself really wanting to stop, but you stay with that tension just a little bit longer, then you let it go. And you take a deep breath and then you move your attention up to your calves and you tense your calves and your thighs as hard as you can. And you keep that tension and you hold it there as long as you can, so long that it feels a little uncomfortable. And you notice yourself starting to want to not keep that tension there, but you keep that tension there just a little bit longer. And then you relax that tension and then you take a deep breath in between and you keep moving up your body this way. This is a way to get that sort of physical activity mm-hmm. that gets coded by your brain as if you were running without actually running.
Got it.
Then another one of my favorites while you are doing this, and this is one that actually really was transformative for Amelia, because she was already like exercising 4 times a week on the elliptical machine, like she was supposed to do. She was doing all the things she was supposed to do, and it wasn't helping. So in addition to like when she was on the elliptical or when you're sitting on the train and your body's in this tense state, not only are you activating these muscles, you're also actively imagining yourself doing something that would, if you did it in real life, result in conquering whatever your enemy is. So for Amelia, she'd be on the elliptical machine and an ordinary workout, she just end up like sweaty and tired at the end of it. But then she learned about all this stress response cycle stuff, and she would be on the elliptical machine and imagine herself as Godzilla tromping on like the parking lot in the administrative buildings of the university where she was struggling so hard. And instead of just feeling tired and hot at the end, she felt victorious and like she had like destroyed her enemy. So if you add imagination as, and we know that imagination can start stress responses, mm-hmm. right? You just start worrying about
fear,
stuff.
Yeah,
you notice your body. Yeah, right? Imagination can start stress responses and it can complete stress responses if you allow your body and brain to go through the process of escaping or conquering whatever your enemy is.
Wow. So if you, I mean, Godzilla stomping on whatever her stress was is a very fantastical idea. Can you just envision yourself like actually, I guess, dealing with it in reality? Or does it need to be some like fantasy, like big picture, you know?
It has to be something your body would recognize on evolutionary terms as survival. So it can't be like fixing the train so that it goes and then driving the train to the station. It can't be pragmatic problem solving.
It can't be like writing a scathing email.
Yeah, no, I mean, if only, but it can be like taking a jackhammer to the train and like physically destroying it. It can be like punching somebody in the face.
Wow.
It can be like, it has to be like physical using your body and imagining it in this very vivid way so that you feel your body doing like tensing. You feel the tension in your jaw and your hands and your shoulders, and you feel an activation inside you, and your body will tell you when you get to the end of it. For someone like me, where you have this intuition of what it feels like, whereas if you're not someone who has the intuition, who knows when like you get to the end, you'll just know you feel a little bit better.
Uh-huh.
Just, if you're like on a 9 on the tension scale and you can get yourself down to a 6, that's a really big difference in your state of mind.
And so remind everyone listening how this prevents burnout. Is it also the solution to burnout if you're already how do you know? Okay, let me back up. How do you know if you are burnt out? Like, besides being hospitalized, just somebody listening, myself, am I burnt out? How do I know?
So this is a hilarious question that I love. We literally say, like in the introduction, while we were writing the book, nobody ever asked. We would say we're writing a book called Burnout. Nobody said, oh, what's burnout?
Oh, that's hilarious.
People seem to have like an intuitive understanding of what it feels like in their bodies and in their thoughts and in their emotions when they have reached the end. But there is a technical definition.
Well, weirdly, I don't know. Let me, sorry to interrupt, but my thing is like, am I being dramatic? Like maybe I'm just like sometimes, you know, excitement can translate in the body as stress. Am I just excited about all the work?
It's you stress, positive stress.
Mm-hmm. That's why it's the same in your bot, right? Like, because I have, you know, a sensitive stomach, right. IBS stuff. And I've always said that excitement about, you know, something epic I'm doing can upset my stomach the same way that negative stress, like worrying or something bad happening, can upset my stomach, because your body processes it the same.
It's not chemically identical, but it is broadly the same system. Yes, exactly.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. So that's why I'm sort of like, well, maybe burnout, I don't know. It's hard. And maybe that's just,
it's useful to have something. I don't mean it this way. I don't mean it's like what a gift it is to have IBS, but
I think it is a gift. I say that all the time. I'm so grateful for it because it helps me know when to slow down.
Yeah. It's a hard limit.
Yes.
Like your body just won't let you get away with doing to it what my sister's body let her get away with. Okay. And I feel the same way about my sort of sensitivity to stress, that my body just won't let me push myself as close to the edge as my sister did. She was so good at tuning out, at shutting things off, at like just not paying any attention to what her body was trying to tell her, that she could get to the point where she woke up in the middle of the night with abdominal pain so intense that she had her husband drive her to the hospital.
Wow. Okay.
Like your body just won't go there.
But so that's probably the people then that experience burnout, right? The ones that don't have whatever barometer, you know, like telling them, yo, you're stressed out, take a nap. Like your sister was like, nap? No, I'm plowing through, until her body just collapsed.
Yeah. Mm. And it does. So the technical definition, burnout actually has three components. The first is emotional exhaustion, where you're just worn out from caring about too much for too long. Second is a sense of decreased accomplishment, where you keep working really hard and accomplishing less and less. And then the third is depersonalization, where you lose your sense of empathy and compassion. And for women, it's really that first one, emotional exhaustion, that is the key burnout characteristic, where you just feel like you've given everything you have to give. As Sarah Knight would put it, you have given all the fucks you have to give. Yeah. You are all out of fucks. You have no more fucks to give. And yet the world is demanding more fucks from you.
Yeah.
Because of human giver syndrome.
And so how do you, in that situation, I mean, you can't just tell the world, stop giving me fucks. What do you do? Like, is it the answer, complete the stress response cycle? Like, what do you do?
So it's got to be both things, right? There's this process of dealing with the stress in your body, which you absolutely must do, or else your body will gradually degrade and ultimately kill you. And then there's dealing with the stressors in your life, the actual source of stress, which is sort of the first step, is distinguishing between the stressors you can control and the stressors you cannot control.
This is Sarah's new book. Exactly. Yeah. Her new book. Yeah. That's funny.
One of the things that we talk about, I love Sarah to pieces, and I sent her Burnout in an earlier draft. And we both have the same feeling about each other's work, that like, I do all like the science and the like, no, let me prove it to you that this is actually working. She's profoundly intuitive and really funny and gives the same basic advice, but says it in an entertaining way. And like, if you need the proof and like an evidence-based strategy, read my book. If you sort of already know what you're doing and want it to be hilarious, Sarah.
Yeah, that's fun. So
we have
awesome.
The same messages. That's We're talking really about cool. the same stuff. But Amelia and I are the nerds who need to be convinced.
That's
and
good.
And so yeah, we do all the convincing work. And we also talk about sort of like the dark stuff, the patriarchal forces that deprive women of a sense of basic bodily autonomy, grounding this whole burnout phenomenon, which women arguably burn out more than men. They burn out differently from men. And that's not random. It's because the cultural expectations are different, that we are expected to sacrifice ourselves. Like if you came into work one day and you said, you guys, I got 9.5 hours of sleep last night, I feel fantastic. How would people respond to that?
If you had kids, they would be like, what are you neglecting your kids? How selfish.
Exactly. Like, how dare you? How selfish.
Yeah.
Exactly. right? Whereas if you said, oh my God, I was up until 4 o'clock in the morning decorating the cupcakes for Becky's birthday party.
What a mom.
You are, oh my gosh, like we valorize exhaustion and sacrifice. And sleep is a physiological need like food. And I have lost count of the number of women who've told me they feel guilty for sleeping, that it's selfish for them to, because when you sleep, you're only helping yourself after all.
I sometimes think sleep's a waste of time. I'm like, this is so boring. I'd rather be doing something.
Chapter 7. Amelia didn't want me to write as much as I did about like how important sleep is, how much your brain and body are doing while you're asleep. They need you to lie down and stop doing everything so your brain and body can fix all the damage that you've done to your body over the course of the day. If you engage in physical activity, you did a little damage to your bones and your muscles and your cardiovascular system. And at night while you're sleeping, your body repairs all that damage and makes you even stronger. If you went through any sort of like emotional distress over the course of the day, you did a little damage to your brain. Mm-hmm. And in your sleep, your brain repairs that damage and makes you a little more emotionally resilient. If you had a relationship conflict over the course of the day, you did damage to that relationship. Overnight, your brain begins to repair that damage and helps you wake up with strategies to rebuild the bridge between you and the person with whom you had that relationship conflict. Human beings are not complete without sleep. Sleep is not a waste. If you don't get the sleep and you exercise, then you don't repair the damage you did to your bones and muscles and cardiovascular system so that the next day you're actually more prone to injury.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, if you are not sleeping, better not exercise. If you are not sleeping, better not try to drive a car. If you're not sleeping, better not try to have relationships or parent someone. A person who's only had 4 hours of sleep in one night is as impaired as a person who's legally intoxicated.
Wow.
So, well, don't try to do things you wouldn't do if you were drunk. You know, drive, work, parent.
Anything. Yeah. Wow. So what is your recommended hours of sleep?
What the research says is 7 to 9 hours. Mm-hmm. People vary in their natural needs. I am a 7.5 hour person.
Yeah, same.
My sister, again, identical twin, is a 9 hour person.
Wow.
If she only gets 8, she really feels it.
Fascinating.
So get the amount of sleep that your body needs, and also sleep if you possibly can. I know this is a tough one, but like, can you organize your life in a way that lets you sleep according to your body's natural sleep cycles? I'm a person who wants to go to bed at 9 and wake up at 5.
Right. I just had someone on talking about that. I forget the name of the test, but there's a test you can take that says if you're like a bear or a lion. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I've only ever heard of larks and owls.
Oh, it's this test. It tells you like what your best hours are, but I guess you could just figure it out based on how you operate.
Yeah, I know that my body wants to be asleep at a certain time. It wakes up and I have this enormous burst of creative energy early in the morning, you know, between 5 and 10 a.m. is when I get most of my writing done. And by noon, like I'm done with my creative work. I can do physical work at that point, but I'll only have a little window of creative time in the evening. Otherwise, I'm done with being able to do intellectual work.
I'm with you. Yeah.
And lots of people are totally the opposite. They do the best, most creative work late at night.
That's my husband. Yeah. He's up to like 2 a.m. I'm in bed. I come out to pee and he's like sitting there writing stuff and like brainstorming our next activity. And I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah. My husband is the same way. In the early years of our marriage, I sort of had to figure out how, like, what do we do about the fact that I go to bed hours before he does? And then he sleeps hours after I do. So there's all this. There's only a limited amount of time. We're both awake at the same time.
It's so funny. But it was a toughie for us when we moved in together. I mean, we moved in 5 years ago now. But it was definitely weird because I'm like, well, I'm just sitting here on a Saturday morning. It's 6 a.m. and you're going to sleep till 10. What kind of life is that? What am I supposed to do?
Yeah, exactly.
So funny. But you have to just honor it. Where does meditation fall into this? Because I'm surprised that one of the ways to complete the stress response is not, as so far as what you've said, is meditation. You're saying get the movement to get the energy out and the emotion pass through you, not sit there and ohm. Talk to me about meditation.
Yeah, meditation is great for some people. And we do include deep breathing exercises, especially for folks with a history of neglect, trauma, or abuse. paying attention to your breath, and especially long, slow exhaling breaths, is the gentlest way in to letting your body release the stress that's living in your body. We don't emphasize it, though, because as a somatic experiencing practitioner I talked to once said, there's a lot of freeze in the meditation and yoga communities because there's such an emphasis on calmness and peace and balance and a sense of just lightness, mm-hmm. that it ignores the fact that we're carrying around all of this activation in our bodies. And we think that we're supposed to be still. And that if we can make ourselves still, that's the equivalent to getting rid of the activation. And it's not. Freeze is when you hit the brakes in the middle of your stress response activation. And it's a denial of all the stuff that's actually happening in your body. There's a yoga instructor I adore, maybe worship, named Jessamine Stanley. She has an app called the Underbelly Yoga app. And one of the things I love about her yoga instruction is that she's incredibly dynamic and permissive about, like, if you want to bounce here, go ahead and bounce. If you lose your balance, you know, you just get back up. If you fall down, nobody's here to judge you. If somebody judges you for falling down, that person is an asshole.
That's funny. So that bounce around.
That it's just like move around, let your body do what it needs to do, feel what your body feels like in this position, and give it the movement that it asks for or the stillness that it asks for. Because so much of my personal experience of yoga, going to yoga classes and practicing that way, was about performance, particularly because I have a background in dance. I took 15 years of ballet, tap, and jazz. Wow. Which is about, like, you know, performing my body according to these, like, rigid definitions of what was correct and what was incorrect. I brought that to my yoga practice and I was rewarded for it.
Yeah.
Like, whether my body hit the positions correctly. Mm-hmm. Turns out that's not what yoga is.
Oh, it's not a competition or a recital?
Right. Yeah. No, it's not a performance. Right?
Yeah.
Totally. And so it took me finding teachers like Jessamine Stanley to help me recognize that I could practice yoga in all of its forms, including various meditations and breathing, without being worried about performance or what I look like or being calm. I'm a person who cries when I practice yoga. I'm a crier. My body wants to let stuff go, let it out. So particularly when I do, like, hip flexion, my body is like, your feelings, let the feelings go. Uh-huh. So I call it ugly yoga, ugly meditation. I find it impossible to meditate while being still. There's a wonderful sex book I recommend to people who are struggling with anything related to sexuality called Better Sex Through Mindfulness. Because mindfulness genuinely is an evidence-based practice for so many different kinds of... Sorry, that was my phone. Why didn't I turn the sound off?
I could barely hear it. You're totally fine. Now we made a big ordeal out of it. But
So I recommend this book, Better Sex Through Mindfulness. Mindfulness truly is an evidence-based practice for coping with a whole lot of difficulties, including anxiety and depression and even IBS and chronic pain and lots of sexual difficulties like anorgasmia and desire difficulties and arousal difficulties. And my own mindfulness practice is nothing like what any sort of mainstream mindfulness teacher talks about. You hear mindfulness teachers say things like, step outside of your own awareness and consciousness and watch it like a stream or like traffic. And I like that analogy, except that when I step outside my own thought process, when I watch my own attention, it's not a stream. It is like 40 fire hoses all firing simultaneously. And it's very entertaining, but it never feels like peaceful and calm, and my brain never goes quiet. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that that is what it's like for some people, but our priority, again, because Amelia and I are so different from each other, even though we're identical twins, our priority was to make sure we had something in there that was going to work for everybody. So that if this doesn't work for you, try this instead. And if that doesn't work, try this instead. There's at least 8 options, and they are all evidence-based, depending on what's going to work for you, based on your temperament, your lifestyle, the cultural rules that govern what's possible for you, even whether or not you've got kids and you have time to access any of these resources.
Wow. Where do thoughts play into all this? I mean, I assume the answer is you can't think your way out of the stress cycle.
Yeah. But the one and only thing we know for sure does not work to complete the stress response cycle is telling yourself that everything is fine now. Everything is fine now. Just relax. Like that, nope, doesn't do anything. It's like telling yourself to digest. Everything is fine now. You just go ahead and digest that food. You just go ahead and keep breathing. Hey, lungs, keep on inflating. You just have to give yourself what your body needs and allow it to do what it needs to do.
Wow. There's such an emphasis, though, on thoughts, on mantras, and what you think creates your life, and how powerful our thoughts are. I guess in some ways, are they powerful based on your research, or are you saying in nada?
It's not that they're nothing. It's that people often... So I was at an event last week where someone was talking about how self-limiting beliefs are the only thing that stand between us and everything we want. And my sister and I looked at each other like, because the patriarchy doesn't exist, because there's no such thing as racism, because poverty's not a thing, because chronic illness isn't a thing. My chronic illness is not caused by my self-limiting beliefs. It's caused by damage to my vestibular system caused by antibiotics I took in my 20s. So fuck you a little bit. Like, that's not caused by my self-limiting beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I find it enormously dismissive of the structural barriers that women in particular face, women of color especially face, that it's your self-limiting beliefs, okay? Or maybe it's like, you know, white supremacist, cis heteropatriarchal capitalism that's standing in my way. Just for example, just this is a random example. Oh, so thoughts aren't nothing, but sometimes thoughts can be actively destructive. So crying is a great example because I use this analogy of crying as diarrhea.
Yeah.
Like you would not continue eating the food that caused the diarrhea while you were having it, right?
Right.
So you don't continue thinking the thoughts that activate the stress. You don't keep thinking about the problem that caused all that emotion. You stop the thinking and you shift your attention just to like, what are the physical sensations happening while I'm crying? What does this feel like in my body? How does my heart feel? What do I long for? Like, where's the tension? Where's the heat? What does my breathing feel like in this moment? Stop thinking about what caused the problem. The crying is not about solving the... Anybody who says crying never solved anything doesn't know the difference between dealing with the stress versus dealing with the problem that caused the stress.
I just want to separate that. Dealing with the stress, dealing with the problem that... So the stress is the physiological response, right? And the problem is the too many work emails, you know, too many emails, rejection letter, husband fight, kid annoying. It's the actual thing.
Why won't my children put on their shoes? Yeah. That's a stressor.
Got it. You know, so going back to that like limiting belief, whatever that woman was telling you that got you all riled up. You know, there's so much information out there about...
It was not a woman.
Oh, I thought you said it was a woman.
No, it was totally a white man.
Oh, okay. The white
a
man.
A very rich white man.
Got it. Okay. That explains more of the riling up.
Yeah, that may have influenced how frustrated I felt. I pictured like oh my God.
But there's so much conflicting, I guess, information out there about stress. Like, oh, just use, you know, lavender oil or take a bath or, you know, blah, blah, blah,
blah. Like, I love lavender oil and I love taking a bath, but this whole self-care thing.
Yeah. Talk to me because
I'm in
I don't
favor?
Want you to, okay. Yeah. I don't want you to like dismiss because like we talk a ton about that, but you're
self-care
saying.
Self-care is important.
Okay.
And it is the fallout shelter you build in your basement because apparently it's your job to protect you from nuclear war.
Right.
So self-care, like do it.
Yes.
Take care of you. Do what you need to do to take care of you and the people you love. But ultimately the answer, like the true solution to burnout isn't just self-care. That makes it all your responsibility to cope with stress that is being caused by issues that you didn't get to pick. you didn't choose to be in the life that you, like, you didn't choose the body you were born into or the social status you were born into. You didn't choose a lot of the factors about your life. You didn't get to pick whether or not you had a different sexual orientation or different abilities or whether you were neurotypical. You didn't pick that stuff. You got planted into a life and you're expected to be able to cope with everything that life throws at you. And the reality is, again, humans are 90% chimp, 10% bee. We are at our most powerful when we're connected. The answer isn't just self-care. The answer is care. Mm. It is all of us caring for each other, turning toward each other's difficult feelings with kindness and compassion. Humans are not built to do big things alone. Oh, yeah. We're built to do them together.
As a team. As a hive. That's so cool to look at that way. Okay, so it's not that lavender oil and baths is bullshit. It's that to end the stress cycle, I can't emphasize this enough because I've never heard this before, and I think this is it's clearly groundbreaking.
That's chapter one. So, like, you just read one chapter and you're good.
Bye. Return that book. No, just kidding. Right. but, like, you just got to basically shake it out. Like, get it move. It's amazing because it's like a manifesto to physical movement or sex, making out, kissing, hugging.
Yeah, to like physical connection, physical movement, laughter is another thing.
Yes,
on the list.
I'm breathing, so glad you said that.
Crying.
Wait, talk more about laughter because
Oh, laughter it's like orgasm.
Yes.
It is this intensely social behavior where you release enormous stress, especially when you're laughing with other people. What the research has found is even just talking with a friend about a time you have laughed together changes your chemistry. It returns you to that state of peace and joy and completes the stress response cycle. But if you can, like, and I'm not talking about social posed laughter, like, but like the embarrassing, helpless, like, convulsive laughter that is hysterical and makes it hard to breathe and you cry while you're doing it. And at the end of it, it's like you've been in an altered state of consciousness.
Yes.
Laughter. Oh. Yeah. My sister does laughter yoga with her choir sometimes.
That's funny. I was going to ask you when you were talking about the like bouncing around yoga, I was going to ask about laughing yoga.
Yeah, left. Yeah, that's shit's evidence based.
Wow, evidence based. That's awesome. And that's just when you're doing yoga, but then someone just starts laughing, and then it kind of like spirals, and everyone's just like cracking up.
No, laughter yoga is an explicit practice where you get a leader to come in and go, everybody go, ha 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 ha.
Oh, I thought it was.
Yeah, it's like a whole thing, and at first it's totally fake. But it gradually builds where you like look at each other while you're doing this sort of like fake laughter type behavior. And by the end of it, you are all just convulsed in genuine deep laughter.
That's amazing.
It's truly miraculous. I call it the magic trick, this phenomenon that happens to our bodies. Neuroscientists call it crossing a neurological bridge out of your own personal identity into a sense of oneness and connection with the other people or with the universe. And that's like, if you can spend, you know, half an hour a week or even half an hour a month in that transported place of connection and deep unity, that is the ultimate answer to burnout.
Oh my goodness. Well, I used to perform stand-up comedy and I'm obsessed with laughter. I find it as healing as you're talking. I mean, it's just the greatest thing in the world. Even when I go to comedy shows and a brilliant comedian's up there and the whole audience is just laughing, it's just clear that everyone's just released. Everyone's just free. And we're also like a team, you know, because we're sharing this experience and we're all just free. And it's a beautiful thing.
You're co-creating it.
Yeah. It's remarkable.
So my sister, again, she's a choral conductor. She creates musical experiences like that for a living.
That's
one of the reasons why she feels like she has stayed as sane and stable and survived everything she has is because she makes these beautiful artistic musical moments with other people for her job.
Mm.
And it like keeps her rooted in what her purpose is in life and in how to be connected and loving with other people.
That's wonderful. Wow, that's so cool. All right, well, I have to ask, where does sex fall into this? Because this whole thing started from you writing a book on sex that blew up, and then you had a chapter about stress, and that's where this second book exploded from. So where did that chapter even fall into the first book?
Yeah, so The deal with sex is that the sex is governed in your brain by a mechanism called the dual control mechanism. Dual control mechanism means it's got two parts. And the first part is the sexual accelerator or gas pedal, which responds to all the sex-related information in the environment. That's, you know, everything that you see and hear, smell, touch, taste, or imagine that your brain codes as a sex-related stimulus, and it sends the turn-on signal. But at the same time, and in parallel, you have that second mechanism, the brake, noticing all the reasons not to be turned on right now. Everything that you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or imagine that your brain codes as a potential threat. And so the process of arousal is this dual process of turning on the ons and turning off the offs. And the single most common thing that keeps the brakes on is stress. Mm-hmm. And so, having spent my life as a health educator, a sexuality educator primarily, but a health educator in general, I had learned that people sort of don't know how to deal with their stress. They think, like you said, like meditation, they need to just learn to be calm. Or like Amelia's doctor said, you just relax.
Yeah, or just change your thoughts. Turn the dial.
Yeah, because if you're in a state of, like, if your brain is convinced you're being chased by a lion right now, is that a good time to be having sex?
Perhaps not.
And can you just decide that you're not being chased by a lion anymore?
That's not how it works. Actually being when are our bodies going to freaking catch up with the times? We're not being chased by lions anymore. Are we always going to be programmed like that forever and ever and ever?
I mean, for our lifetime, it will stay that way. But the more we can do to give our body what it needs to honor it as it is, instead of being frustrated with it for not matching our environment, because it is true that we do not live in an environment that matches
what our physiological
needs are.
And
like, we need to be really like forgiving of our bodies for not matching our environment. It's not their fault. They didn't decide. You know what though? I'm going to stay like real paleolithic. I don't care about this whole 21st thing. It like 21st century situation where, right? It's just, like, your body's doing its best for you.
Yeah.
It is trying, to be there for you if it can, and it could use your help.
Mm-hmm.
So, in chapter 4 of Come As You Are, I was like, here are some things you can do to help your body get to a place where it feels like you have escaped from the lion, particularly because women in particular, sex sometimes is the lion. It's been used against them as a weapon, or they were raised their entire lives to believe that sex is a dangerous and disgusting source of pain or shame. And we have to teach ourselves not to respond with a stress response to sex itself,
mm-hmm.
or we have to help our bodies release the stress that we're carrying around so that the brake can release, so that the accelerator can do its job and we can access sexual pleasure.
Wow. I get it. That was very clear. That makes so much sense.
Oh, hooray.
Good job. Well done. You're an expert and you lived up to it. No, that's amazing. So that's where the stress played into the first book, and that's where this all started. And that's, I'm just putting it all together in my head right now. That makes a lot of sense. And
it's good that makes sense, because there's actually a Come As You Are workbook coming next in June. And again, there's a whole chapter on like stress worksheets. It is just like chock-a-block worksheets, things you can do to make the science work in your life, to increase your access to pleasure, desire, arousal, connection, ecstasy. And part of that involves reducing your stress levels. It's a good thing that makes sense, because I just have to spend a whole bunch of time writing that chapter.
Well, thank you. Good. I'm happy to be your guinea pig. But let me ask you this. If you're in the moment, you know, you're about to have sex, you're like getting in the mood, and based on what you're telling me now, we can't just now like shake it out, or we can't like think our way out of it. We're not going to cry. Is there a way, like in the moment, to be like, all right, let's turn that brake, whatever you said, pause the brake and accelerate. Like, how can you do that in a timely fashion?
Define in the moment.
Like you're doing it, like you're starting to do it, and you're like, ugh, I'm not really in the mood. Okay, gotta get in the mood. Like, get in the mood. How do you get in the mood? Okay, like that type of stuff.
Yeah. So I learned this fantastic metaphor from a sex therapist in New Jersey named Christine Hyde. Here's how she talks about it with her clients. If your best friend invites you to a party You say yes, of course, because it's your best friend and it's a party. And then as the date approaches, you start going, oh, it's going to be really heavy traffic. We have to find childcare. Am I really going to feel like putting on my party clothes at the end of a long week? I don't know. But you said you would go. So you put on your party clothes and you get the childcare and you go to the party. And what happens? You have fun at the party. Mm-hmm. If you are having a good time at the party, you are doing it right. But it takes doing some things. It takes putting on your party clothes. It takes like doing your makeup. You engage in a little bit of that sort of like pampering kind of self-care stuff to you, like play the music while you're putting on the body glitter to get yourself in the party mood, right? Uh-huh. And we do the same thing when it's sexuality. Like Saturday at 3 o'clock, you, me, and the red underwear. You show up to the party and you do That's the things great. That you know from experience help get you in the party mood. And you know what? If you show up to a party and you don't like any of the people and they're not serving the kind of food you enjoy and these are not party games that you like or feel good about, there is no amount of like being ready and wanting to go to a party that will make that a party worth going to.
Right.
So it's really not about the desire. There's a sex therapist and researcher named Peggy Kleinplatz, and the way she puts it is, what kind of sex is worth wanting? So if you can figure out what you can create with your partner that you actually really want to do, that makes you glad to be going to that party so that when you show up, you know good things are going to happen. That's how partners can co-create a sexuality where both people are glad to set some time aside and like make that party happen.
That's perfect. That's awesome. What a great analogy. Parties are the best analogy because we're, you know, talking party in my plants here too. So it's a mm-hmm. great analogy for everything. So that on that topic, let me just ask you my final party planty questions and I'll let you go. What is your favorite plant to eat?
Oh, there's so many.
I know.
It's
always a stumper.
Probably fennel, actually. Ooh,
I've yeah. never gotten that one before.
Really?
You fancy.
Because it's, I like it raw, but I also like it cooked.
Yeah.
I like using the like little green leaves as sort of garnish, but I also like having fennel be like the main ingredient. And I've got sauce and some other things mixed in there. And it's got this like really light sort of licorice-y kind of flavor.
Yeah.
I love fennel.
Great for digestion.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Is it actually like
soothing
for
the tum-tum?
Besides just being fucking
yeah.
delicious?
Yeah.
Right.
Woohoo. That's awesome. Is there a favorite restaurant in your neck of the woods, which is in the Massachusetts, in the woodsy Massachusetts, that you like to get good veggies?
Yeah. There's a place called Bella, B-E-L-A, in downtown Northampton. That it's one of the restaurants where my husband and I fell in love. We went on dates early in our relationship there a lot.
I've never heard of it. I know the other one that's like a person's name. What's the one? It's above like an ice cream place. It's like in like a strip mall with like a bookstore.
Oh, yeah. Paul and Elizabeth.
Yeah, the name.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know Bella,
that place is great. I love it there. But Bella is really, I mean, it's a very small little sort of slightly out of the way place.
I'm stoked.
And I just love it there. They have a vegetarian meatloaf. That is what my husband's like favorite thing to get in Northampton.
Oh my God. Well, we're going to Northampton in next weekend. So I will have to go to Bella.
Look for it, yeah.
Let y'all know how it is. Amazing. Okay. What is your favorite thing that you do for self-care?
Oh, there's a lot. That's the thing is like, I've been forced to think about my self-care a whole lot. I though am a sleep evangelist.
I can tell.
I protect
you got yeah.
my sleep like, and it's not like the most glamorous thing I do. I also really enjoy like Lush bath bombs and face masks. And I like all that stuff. But like the foundation of it all is that 7.5 hours of sleep.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And we let our dogs sleep in our bed because that's who we are. And she will often sleep spine to spine with me.
Oh.
And I find that really like comforting and reassuring. So sleeping in the bed with the dog. She goes to bed when I do, as opposed to waiting for my husband
to
come up
too.
Later.
Yeah. Yes. And then Jesse will walk our dog, Tommy, like later. So he's up till like 2 a.m. I go to bed at like 10, but Tommy will sleep with me. And then Jesse will walk him at like 1:30.
Exactly.
That's so
exactly.
funny. Oh, I was going to ask you, I wrote it down and forgot. When you say the 6-second hug, Can that count to hug your dog?
6-second kiss.
20-second hug. Can you 20-second hug your dog? Does that count?
It's not quite the same, but it is absolutely the case that we can get a sense of connection and safety that changes our chemistry from our animals, from dogs and cats and horses and whatever, like, gives you a sense of like connection with the instinctual animal world. Like I miss my husband when I travel, but man, the look on my dog's face when I get home from a trip, like that gives me a feeling like nothing else. And if animals are not your thing, we can also get a really similar sense of connection from our connection with the divine. With whatever your experience of God is, one of the best things is that, like animals, our connection with divine love is way less complicated and more perfect than our connection with humans, which tends to be like, you know, they've got needs that they want to have met from us. So there's a little more like work to be done in those sorts of relationships. But divine love is this really like pure way to access a sense of like connection and safety.
So you're saying through prayer, through going to a place of worship, through that kind of stuff?
Through meditation.
Okay, through I was going to say meditation. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Meditation. Like if for you meditation is a spiritual practice, which it isn't for everybody, but if it is for you, that's one of the ways that your body can access that sense of like safety and homecoming.
That's fascinating because it is for me. It is my church. I don't really do religious stuff, but meditation is my spiritual connection.
Yeah.
That makes sense why for somebody who meditation is just like an activity, it would be a totally different experience. Thank you for clarifying. Okay. What is a book besides your own that has inspired you in some amazing way?
Well, there's Better Sex Through Mindfulness by Lori Brado. Mm-hmm. There is Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny by Kate Mann. There's a little tiny book called How to Love by Thich Nhat Hanh. Everybody knows who Thich Nhat Hanh is at this point.
Yes.
And that book is just like poetry. And I'm also really, gosh, there's so many. That's three. That's probably
good.
Enough.
That's enough. Okay. And your books, shout them out. Where can people go to find more about you?
So there's Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. That's the sex book. There's Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle by me and my sister Amelia. That's the stress book. Coming out soon is the Come As You Are workbook, which is like just the worksheets and practical how to make sex work for you. There are included some stress worksheets in there too, of course.
Nice.
And then also under the name Emily Foster, I have also written some romance novels. That's a whole other story. Because I thought there had to be a way to write romance novels that was feminist, sex positive, and not least medically accurate.
Oh my God. I really want, I've never read a sex novel, romance novel. I have to read one.
There's a lot of sex in mine. Because that's why I was writing them, is because I wanted to be sex positive. So if you're not into sex, don't start with mine.
Oh,
if that's not what
maybe.
You want to read.
We'll see.
But there's a lot of very sweet romance also. So like less explicit. That's super like inclusive, positive, feminist. It's great.
Wow. What was it like writing that? Was it fun, scary, and other adjectives?
It was 100% fun. It was absolutely. It turns out. So one of the things we didn't talk about as a way to complete the stress response cycle is creative self-expression.
Okay.
So for me, writing fiction, writing nonfiction is my job. Writing fiction is where I go to put all my feelings that I don't want in the nonfiction. So all like my stress, my fear, my worry, my hopes and dreams that I'm anxious are not going to come true. I can like transform all of it into storytelling that's fictional. And it's really good for my mental health. When therapists tell you to journal, they are not telling you that the construction of sentences is somehow inherently therapeutic. They're saying that you need a place to go put your feelings, to go like have them and place them somewhere so they're not inside your body and you're also not using them to do harm to anyone you love.
Got it.
So for me, writing fiction is another way that I complete the cycle.
Cool. But that's not like a physical thing. I mean, it is kind of.
I sob on my keyboard while I write.
You are a crier.
I totally am. It.
That's so funny. Amazing. And we'll send, where can everybody find you on social, your website?
Oh, the thing I'm on most often is Instagram. I'm just E. Nagoski on Instagram. My website is emilynagoski.com. That's where you find the calendar of events and traveling and public things that I'm doing. And there's a map too.
Ooh, fancy.
You bet.
Matt, well, thank you so much. This has been amazing and groundbreaking, and I hope it really, really helps a lot of women.
Me too. It's so much fun for me.
Thanks so much for listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. I hope you feel so calmly clear on ways that you can actively work to stop dismissing your stress and physically address your probs before burnout takes over your life. A big thing that I can't stop pondering since hanging up the Skype line with the brilliant Emily is how we all have different tolerance levels and physical expressions of stress, and it's of the utmost importance for us to crack our own codes on this stuff, okay? Okay. Okay. A really non-stressful recap of this chat, plus resources that make healthy eating way less stressful too, are all waiting for you at partyinmyplants.com/147.